Good morning and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director. Noteworthy differences between the Senate and Assembly budgets that are affecting you and your organization.
Well, good morning, Frank. As you mentioned, we're coming down to the wire, and April 1st is the budget deadline. So it's hard to imagine how we're going to have an on-time budget, but I have to say in the last 4 years we've surprised everybody and come up with one. So right now we have a very interesting situation because, as you know, we've got a new speaker. So the familiar hand at the wheel of Sheldon Silver is no longer there. And there are ongoing conversations between both houses and the governor. The three men in the room are meeting and having lots of conversations. Right now, there are several differences between the one houses. For example, the Assembly is supporting the DREAM Act. The governor is, supporting it but tying it to other measures. The Senate is not. The Senate is strongly supporting the Educational Investment Tax Credit, which is something that we discussed on this show just last month, which would be a tax credit for people who want to send their children to private schools. And they would be eligible for large tax credits and incentives. There's a number of disagreements over ethics reform. Just last week, the governor and the Assembly reached a deal on ethics reform, and the Senate is still holding out for several other aspects of ethics reform. There are differences on things like charter schools, on economic development, and this is all in the context of, the governor really doing a showdown with both houses of the legislature over a number of issues that traditionally would not have been considered budget issues.
We're now pleased to be joined on the telephone by the Honorable Marcos Crespo, who represents the 85th Assembly District in the Bronx in the State Assembly, and who earlier this month was elected chairman of the Bronx Democratic Committee in a unanimous vote. He's succeeding in that position Assemblyman Carl Hastie, who stepped down as Bronx County leader when he was named Speaker of the Assembly last month. Assemblyman Crespo, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
This is Brian McDonald, and I'd also like to welcome our guest, the Honorable Marcos Crespo, to the People's Business here on WRPI Troy. Assemblyman Crespo was first elected to the Assembly in a special election in June of 2009 to fill the seat that was left vacant when then-Assemblymember Ruben Diaz was elected Bronx Borough President. He was since then been elected in 2010, 12, and 14. Our main topic today, Assemblyman, is the state budget, but before we get into that topic, can you tell us a little bit about your first few weeks as county chair?
No, they've been busy and stressful, but it's a great opportunity that my colleagues have entrusted in me, and we're looking forward to continuing the Bronx being on the up, on the rise, on a number of positive factors, and as well as the unity that we have created amongst our various elected officials. So it's we're in a good place, and it's an exciting opportunity.
Well, you certainly have large shoes to fill. Your predecessor in that role became the Assembly Speaker, and the predecessor in your current Assembly seat is the Bronx Borough Chair. And I think there was a unique partnership between those two elected officials that have really taken the Bronx and put it in the forefront in New York State politics.
Yeah, no, they certainly have had very successful careers and continue to do a great job representing our community. And so you're right, there are big shoes to fill, but I have big feet.
Okay. Our guest this evening, Marcos Crespo, is a graduate of John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and he served as the chair of the Assembly Task Force on New Americans. His Assembly bio says that as chair of the Task Force on New Americans, he's worked hard to advance issues facing the 4.3 million immigrants. That's quite a number, 4.3 million immigrants that call New York home. And he's authored and both houses of the legislature have passed the most comprehensive anti-fraud measure to protect immigrants in over 30 years. Tell us about that legislation.
Yeah, that was a bill that I worked on even before I got elected. Former Assemblyman Richard Brodsky and former Senator Eric Schneider, and now the Attorney General, each had versions of a bill that dealt with fraud measures. They introduced those at a time when they were both running for the Attorney General seat. I kind of assisted in Richard's version of that bill, and really took it to heart because it's an issue that I've always understood the impact that it's had on communities and in my community, my own family. So as soon as I got elected, I introduced a version of it, and I've been working on it ever since. And the idea was to try and create better measures and protections against legal fraud and immigration service fraud. In the state of New York, we allow for non-attorney providers, immigrant assistant providers, to do a certain amount of work, but there's a lot of confusion because in the Latino community in particular, notaries, or in our communities call them notarios, are attorneys. But yet here, a notary is just someone who took an exam and swore an oath to ensure that anyone who signs a document is the individual who's signing, and a few other, you know, things that they can do, but certainly not the same level of expertise. And so what we see is a lot of confusion with individuals who use that title of notary to confuse clients and really steal their one path or opportunity to citizenship or status. And so we work really hard on this, and the bill does three basic things. It increases the penalties for those that commit fraud significantly. It creates clear measures about what is the type of work and the scope of work that non-attorney providers can provide. And it also codified the Office of New Americans, which was an initiative the Governor Cuomo created, these offices throughout the state to provide services to various immigrant communities. And we wanted to make sure that those became permanent state agency, state services, and not, you know, subject to the next administration's dismissal.
Well, this sounds like a real public service, getting these anti-fraud measures on the books.
I think they were important, particularly when we were expecting federal immigration reform. We wanted to make sure that before folks were enticed to come out of the shadows and seek out those opportunities, that, you know, that we address the issue of that we know comes up year after year, which is the fraud.
The Senate and Assembly are now in the final days of negotiations over the state budget for the 2015-16 fiscal year. What budget issues are you most concerned with at this point in the process?
Look, I think all of us are concerned about the education component of the budget. There is, you know, so much being discussed in such a short time frame. You know, none of us expected nor want to see so many policy issues necessarily tied to budget issues and budget allocations, and revenues. But it is what it is. We find ourselves in this position. Yeah, you could thank Silver V. Pataki for giving the governor the ability to basically go this route and threaten the idea of an extender, which forces us into a really bad potential situation or government shutdown, which none of us want to see. I think we're working in good faith to try to get a good budget done. But there's just a lot to consider in a very short period of time, and all of these changes have significant impacts. I, for one, support a lot of the governor's ideas as it relates to the DREAM Act being in the budget, education investment tax credit being in the budget. I believe that with thousands of parents in my community on waiting lists for charter schools, that I would like to see more of them. But I also have serious concerns about the evaluation proposal as it was first proposed. I think that, you know, focusing so much on exams and those tests and the results of those tests doesn't take into account the totality of the issues that affect children. One of those issues we highlighted during the recent Somos el Futuro conference, and that's the issue of poverty. We're seeing an increased rate of children living in poverty of all, you know, ethnic backgrounds. And it's not just an urban minority city issue. It's an issue that we're seeing in every city across the state, in many communities across the state. And I think it's an issue that has relevance to the educational conversation. When you have so many children hungry or living in substandard conditions or just in difficult circumstances, it's really difficult to expect the best from them. And so I think we need to broaden our views of what affects education and begin to address those in conjunction with educational reform policy ideas.
So, Assemblyman, I've noticed that you recently put out some information about child poverty across the state, and you didn't just sort of focus on your district in the Bronx and some of the difficulties faced by children in the Bronx, but really statewide. So I wonder how you feel. Do you think the administration has addressed these issues in the 4 years that Cuomo's been governor, or do you sort of think this has sort of fallen off the table?
I'll tell you what, I think we've lost sight of the issue. I think there are always measures that aim to address it, but what I'm trying to convey is that we need to be very coordinated in our efforts to address this, and it's no longer a one community's issue. One of the reasons we focused on all the numbers across the state is twofold. Number one, as chair of the Hispanic Task Force, we wanted to highlight the growing number of Latino communities across the state and where they stand in the scope of this study, but also, you know, it's amazing to me to see how this issue has affected every community. And I have colleagues from all backgrounds, from all neighborhoods, and from both parties who have begun to speak very loudly about the need for anti-poverty measures in their communities. My hope is that we begin to incorporate this scope of view, this idea that poverty is at the root of so many of the issues that we talk about up here in Albany, that it becomes an underlying factor, that we keep that in mind and try and address it within components of everything that we try and do.
So I'm glad you brought that up because, one of the things that the governor's been talking about is these failing schools, and he's got a proposal that would allow, unelected people or unelected managers or even someone from the private sector to take over a school if it was deemed to be failing after 3 years. Well, of course, there's a huge correlation between failing schools and areas that have high poverty. So rather than sort of addressing the root problem, which, I believe is poverty, the governor sort of focusing on a symptom and not really the major problem.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is my honest opinion. I really think it's a combination of the two. I think the poverty issues are extremely important. I think they are a bigger part of all of these issues that we're talking about. But I don't dismiss the notion that, we should be open-minded and consider certain types of reforms and approaching education in new and innovative ways. I think that, the diversity that exists in our communities, that should be reflected in the diversity of options that families feel is appropriate for them and ensuring that we hold everyone accountable. We, as elected officials, we've been held accountable for our colleagues who have done bad things. That doesn't mean that we all do, but this is the world we live in. I think we're results-oriented a society, and people want to see better outcomes. And I think, I don't want to dismiss one and the other. I think there's a truth to both arguments that while I want to make it our mission to really start talking about the poverty issues in a whole, new and really refreshed approach, but I don't want to lose sight of the importance of making sure that we consider some of these educational reforms and respect the views of those that are in particular communities. I know that in some neighborhoods, for example, there's an overwhelming sentiment that we should be very open-minded to giving somebody else an opportunity to address the educational changes, and others, they feel that none of those are necessary. I'm of the mindset that different things work in different areas, and we should be listening to the local elected officials and giving them an opportunity to kind of dictate how to approach it in their communities.
So deferring to school, outside of New York City, there's obviously in education a lot more democracy. And I mean that with due respect for the New York City system, but New York City is so big compared to the rest of the state. And outside of New York City, school districts are relatively small and they have elected school boards. And so it sounds like you're of the mind that you should defer to the elected local officials.
Well, to the extent that's possible, yes. I mean, you look at, I've heard from colleagues who feel that, the only real issue is, well, there's effects about, the tax cap and how that affects their ability to make the investments that they need, that the formulas are never really run appropriately, and therefore they don't get their fair share of the funding as they should. I've heard different, and some of it is a little, we're not very familiar, I'm not very familiar with how their systems run. But I've also heard from upstate cities representatives who say, look, we've tried all of this already. We want true reforms. We want more dramatic reforms because we don't want to continue to accept systemic failure.
Right. The upstate cities, you're right to focus on them because they have severe educational problems compared to the – it's really a dilemma because the overwhelming majority of school districts in New York State do well. But the upstate urban school districts do have significant problems. And a number of the smaller cities which have urban problems have a lawsuit going on right now. A trial's been in progress since January, and the small cities are fighting, as you say, for adequate state aid.
Right. I mean, funding is a big part of it in terms of having the ability to make the changes and add the programming that we know could impact our communities. But I'll tell you, one of the things that I do agree with the governor is I'm a little bit concerned. In the city of New York, for the last few years, I've been able to put in my newsletter that we have increased school aid. Now, we never increased it to the point of meeting CFE, which is a tremendous problem. But nonetheless, we have made significant improvements or increases in education funding. Yet, as it pertains to schools in my outer borough community, I hardly see that level of change and impact because of that increased funding. So I've never really understood where the money ends up going, and when it's so hard to track with the size of bureaucracy that we have in the city of New York. Under mayoral control, we thought we had created accountability. Certainly the Bloomberg administration sold it that way, but there was no accountability. The man was able to buy himself a third term after saying he would never do that. And so, you know, as angry as we were about his approach to simply closing schools at will and doing those things, you know, hopefully I believe that the Blasio administration is approaching that very differently. But I don't buy into the argument that just putting more money in is the end all of it. I do believe that families want to see systemic changes. We have severe infrastructure needs throughout schools in our communities, and we haven't talked enough about how to address that issue. And again, it's one of those things where we have to begin to be creative. I keep using this analogy. We can tear down the old Yankee Stadium, build four new parks, and build a brand new stadium in a year and a half, but we can't build new schools. We can't do infrastructure repairs because they take forever and cost too much. I mean, some of these things just get really frustrating. Right. For me as an elected official, imagine how the average parent feels who doesn't care about the politics of it.
Right. Given mayoral control eliminating, in effect, the role of the central school board, it's still left open the question of what elements of decentralization to continue. What are your feelings about the role that the local advisory boards play now? And do they have enough of a voice or too much voice? Is there any aspects of decentralization you'd like to change?
I'll tell you what. I grew up and I went to public schools, and you know, I think if I look at my own story and my own experience, I wasn't necessarily the brightest student, but I always had options and opportunities around me, and it helped that there were those in my family that were always encouraging me and pushing me to, you know, to do well. And I think a lot of children may not necessarily have that supportive structure or not enough of them do. But in terms of, I've seen changes to the system, decentralized, centralized. It's almost like a roller coaster. We keep going through. Everybody wants to kind of, you know, just do something different than the last administration and see right. How that goes. And in the end, we're still seeing those stagnant numbers in terms of achievement. Right now, the de Blasio administration in the city, I can speak to that. You know, they've talked about giving the power back to the superintendents. Actually, in the Bronx, I believe almost all of the superintendents were changed, and former educators, principals, and others were put into those positions to work very aggressively with the local CECs, the community education councils, and school principals, and they're going to be held accountable. And so they're trying to recreate this notion of accountability and local control and input, but it's all brand new. We're still seeing, and it's just too early to kind of tell if that's going to work. But, you know, look, I don't think it's rocket science to know that the things that are going to impact kids are in communities where there are socioeconomic concerns and safety concerns and high crime and all those things is give those children after-school programs. Give those children, you know, nutrition programs. Ensure that they have a variety of options to keep them engaged, whether it's the arts, music, the things that supplement, you know, the academic stuff. And, yeah, that's where the funding is truly needed. But I think that even with the amount of money that we currently spend, we should find creative ways of loosening the strings and allowing local communities to be more creative with what is the type of program that is truly going to impact them. The other dynamic is the socioeconomic, the social service defunding that we have engaged in over the last decade. We've decimated social services in communities, and we're not doing enough to support the families. And this is all part of that. And I think that the kind of things that lead to whether a child is in the best position to be successful.
Assemblyman, you've been a strong supporter of the DREAM Act, which would give tuition assistance for immigrants or the children of immigrants in this country. Yesterday, a spokesperson for the governor mentioned that they don't think they have consensus with the legislature right now, and they might be willing to put that issue aside for now. So how do you feel about that?
I'm dismayed. I'm disappointed. And I hope that we still have an opportunity. We're not going to give up on revisiting the issue until, you know, and we'll keep fighting. I mean, the DREAM Act is an important piece of legislation. You could look at the morality of not blaming these children for the sins of their parents or the mistakes that their parents have made. These are kids who were making an investment in the state already, and we shouldn't be denying them opportunities. On the economic side of it, if you put aside the morality or the ethical question, this makes economic sense for the future of the state. This state continues to grow in population in large part due to new immigrants that have come in. Many of those account for the new job creation, new small business startups, you name it. They're contributing to the state. Every year, undocumented residents pay close to $500 million in state taxes alone. So they're paying their fair share. They're contributing. And when we look at the brightest students that we have, to deny them an opportunity and access to a program that doesn't take anything away from anyone else who qualifies, I think is a big mistake. I mean, these are youth that know no other place, speak no other language, and don't want to go anywhere but stay in the state of New York and be a part of our economy. And so making an investment in them makes more sense than offering visas to professionals from abroad to come in, make some money, take good jobs, and then go back home. And so I just think that on the economics of it, it makes sense. And if you look at, I remember visiting some colleagues in upstate New York, and we visited with some dairy farmers and some of the wineries in the Finger Lakes area, and some of them talked about their workers and how vibrant they are and how important they are to their economy, to their ability to keep their doors and their farms open. And so, and they said, look, and we feel for them because of the conditions that they have to, you know, how they have to fear where they are, and we want immigration reform, and we want their children to have opportunities. And this is coming from the remaining industry or big, vibrant industry in upstate New York. And so I think that, you know, across the state, there's a sentiment that we have to kind of change the narrative and start looking at these individuals as just children who deserve opportunities and are going to be a part of our state for the long term.
We're speaking with Assemblyman Marcos Crespo, who represents the 85th Assembly District. It's in the Bronx. He represents that district in Albany, and he was first elected in June of 2009. He chairs the Assembly's Puerto Rican Hispanic Task Force. He also chairs the Task Force on New Americans, and he was recently elected unanimously as the chair of the Bronx Democratic Committee. Assemblyman Crespo's biography says that besides living in New York City and Puerto Rico, besides having the opportunity to experience both of those settings, he also had the experience of living in Peru for 3 years. Selman, how does that international experience inform your legislative priorities?
I'll tell you what, it relates to this educational conversation. I went to school in Peru part of my elementary years, and I studied a year in Puerto Rico and a couple of years in Puerto Rico, and I studied a year in Florida. I went to 4 high schools, 3 different junior high schools, and 3 different elementary schools. I did a couple of years of private school and mostly in public schools. So I got a little bit of a different perspective on many levels, but particularly in Peru. You know, I remember when I first were told we were moving there, like many other people here, I thought of Peru as like a third world country, and I didn't know what I was going to find. What I found was an exceptional educational system where, and obviously the need, right? These are countries that don't necessarily have the level of safety net programs that we know of here, and so the pressure, the social pressure to do well academically and professionally is extremely important to people. And so in Peru, the math that I saw in fourth grade and fifth grade in Peru, I didn't see in New York until high school. And here was the big difference. In Peru, if you bring a calculator to class, it's considered cheating. Whereas in New York, my teachers would say, bring your calculator so you can keep up. And so to me, I always found that interesting. It was the last paper I wrote in high school was about that topic, and the first paper that I wrote in college, I promise it wasn't the same one, was about this topic as well. And so I've always had an interest in these dynamics and why we approach things differently in different communities. And it's, you know, the experience of understanding, you know, when we first moved to Peru, it was a very vibrant economy and we were doing really well. And then we saw the other extreme of that. We had to leave Peru after the first Alan Garcia presidency really just damaged the economy to the point that we could no longer sustain the quality of life. And we moved back to New York to a house that the bank had already foreclosed and had no heat and no hot water. And we kind of went through the extremes of it all. And but it's all shaped my views and my understanding of the things that affect families. Mm.
So, Assemblyman, we're in the last week of March, and we're heading towards the budget deadline. So what do you think? If you had to look into your crystal ball, will we have a budget agreement this week, or will it go into beyond April 1st?
I'm an eternal optimist. I believe we'll have a budget by April 1st, and it'll be on time, and at least that's my hope. And I think that, you know, I still have high hopes that we can reconsider some of the things that now are being discussed as being left out. You know, I think it's in no one's interest to see, you know, a government shutdown or to, you know, allow the governor to come in and, you know, put a budget extender like Patterson tried, you know, did, and force us into really bad options, but or the worst of options, or just, you know, his initial proposal. So I don't know. I do believe that there's been significant conversations, and my hope is that the Senate majority understands some of these issues and comes to the table and works with us. I know the Assembly will continue to be the people's house and fight for the issues that are truly important to families, like education, healthcare spending, and some of the other things we talked about, higher ed, and just so many areas that are important to us. But I do believe and hope that we will have a budget on time.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we have been speaking with the Honorable Marcos Crespo, who represents the 85th Assembly District in the Bronx in the State Assembly in Albany. Assemblyman Crespo, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
After a brief break, we're going to be speaking with Senator Kevin Parker, the Assistant Democratic Conference Leader for Intergovernmental Relations. Assemblyman Parker is in the minority, and one of the things we're going to probe with him is, in the New York State Legislature, where the leadership is so strong, what does someone in the minority party in either house have to do to make an impact on the budget, and what does he think of the controversy that state's U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has weighed in on recently, where she's expressed an opinion that it would be good if we had the Senate Minority Leader Andrea Stewart Cousins at the table in the budget negotiations, if for no other reason that a woman's seat at the table improves these processes. But we'll see what Kevin Parker thinks about the budget process in a few minutes. But right now we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in about 4 or 5 minutes.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Mrs. Johnson. Is Megan there?
Sure. Follow me. The kids are in the kitchen making sandwiches.
Hey, Julie.
Hi,
Jessica. Hi, Megan. Hey, Megan.
Yeah?
You're a total freak. God, you're ugly. And dumb. Oh, and your makeup makes you look like a tramp.
Oh, my God.
Tommy Morris told me you guys made out. Everybody knows. The whole school knows. He said your breath smelled like garbage, and he almost puked. He says you're the most desperate girl he knows. And that dress is totally hideous. You look like a big fat clown. Disgusting. Oh, and by the way, nice zit.
If you wouldn't say it in person, why say it online? Delete cyberbullying. Don't write it, don't forward it. For more information, visit ncpc.org. A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Hi, Betty.
Oh, hey, Bob.
Isn't your sister joining us for lunch?
No, she hardly comes out anymore. She's been pretty depressed lately.
Oh, why is that? Is something wrong?
Well, her doctor says she has macular degeneration. That's one of the leading causes of vision loss for people over 55.
You know, my doctor told me a few years ago that I had macular degeneration and that it was progressing. So I've been vigilant about seeing an eye doctor. And I quit smoking. I eat foods that might help it from progressing any further.
Well, is there a cure?
Well, there's no cure. There is hope, thanks to the Foundation Fighting Blindness. They sent me a free information packet on current treatments, clinical trials, and the latest research on macular degeneration.
That is good news. I should have my sister call them. Do you have their number?
Yeah, sure. Their number is 1-800-BLINDNESS. That's 1-800-254-6363.
Great. I'm going to tell her to call the Foundation Fighting Blindness today.
This is Ellen McElwain. You're listening to WRPI Troy 91.5 FM, just in case you forgot.
Good morning and welcome back to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director. The state legislature is now in the final days of negotiations over the state budget for the fiscal year that begins on April 1st, 2015, which is a week from tomorrow. To help us dig into the budget issues currently being negotiated, we are now pleased to be joined on the telephone by Senator Kevin Parker, who represents a number of neighborhoods in the heart of Brooklyn, in and around Prospect Park. Senator Parker, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Frank. Thanks for having me.
This is Brian McDonald, and I'd also like to welcome our guest, Senator Parker, to the People's Business here on WRPI Troy. Senator Parker has been a guest on this show before. He's also the State Senate's Assistant Democratic Conference Leader for Intergovernmental Affairs and is an articulate advocate for many issues. Senator, with the Assembly and Senate heading towards the April 1st deadline, can you tell us what you think are the sticky issues that may be holding up a budget agreement?
Well, right now, we're really down to a lot of the details around, not just dollar amounts. Some of it is what do you increase money at? And if you're increasing money, you've got to take away money from some other things and that negotiation. But then also, there's a lot of ancillary issues related to the budget, but may not be budget issues per se that are also being discussed. So, for instance, raise the age. New York has the dubious distinction of being one of two states that still prosecute 16-year-olds as adults, and that's been a tough negotiation that's been going on, and we're certainly trying to not just raise it, but do it in a way that makes sense within the context of our criminal justice system, as well as what we do around juvenile justice. Then there's other issues around things like education, which is always contentious, but particularly the governor has a couple of items in this year that I think people have some scratching their heads. One of which is this receivership idea, mm-hmm. which would take failing schools and put them in the hands of the state, which is there's no model for that anymore. There's no model for that in how we've done public education to this point. We haven't even gotten the funding formula right yet. This is another issue where the governor's at odds with people like myself, who believe that until you fully fund public education, you can't talk about some of these other punitive measures that you want to do. That this is not about penalizing teachers, although we certainly think that a fair and common sense approach to teacher evaluations, should be done, but you certainly don't want to be penalizing teachers when you're not fully funding them in the classrooms. And then lastly, both, there's actually kind of dual issues, only because the governor linked them. One is providing some kind of support for parents who are paying an exorbitant amount of money for public school education, for private education, and ways that we can be helpful in that area, as well as the DREAM Act. And DREAM Act is a huge, huge issue, something that we really ought to be doing. The governor had it initially in his executive budget and has now removed it. So I think a lot of the advocates, including myself, on that issue are frustrated by that and are looking to get have the governor fix that before the final budget comes out.
Last week, the Quinnipiac poll and yesterday the Siena poll, they both found that New Yorkers seem to be on a different wavelength than the governor on a number of budget issues. Most of those disagreements deal with policy issues, but several deal with the process. And the biggest gap between the governor and the populace actually deals with the role of the Senate Democratic Conference, of which you are a member, with 85% of voters indicating that they would like to see Senate Minority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins included in the budget negotiations. Is there a practical way to involve the minority leaders in the budget negotiations in New York State and still have them work?
Yes, just invite them to the meetings. This is not rocket science. We've done it before. In fact, Elliot Spitzer did it when he became governor in 2007, and we always had all of the leaders of the legislative parties in the meetings, and certainly we need to continue to make sure that everybody is represented. I mean, I'm just so Cousins represents more than half of the state. Literally, how do you have the Senate represented by only two members who represent New York City and call that a fair representation? And with all due respect to my host, it's two white guys, right? It's like, you know, we are the only conference with African-Americans in the Senate. We're the only conference with African-Americans, only conference with Latinos, only conference with an openly gay member. And none of those people are represented, you know, at the table. We also have the majority of the women. I want to say we now have about 10 women in the entire Senate.
So that's like 40% of your conference is women.
Right, right. And including the leader, right? The only female and the first female legislative leader in the history of the state of New York. And the governor really ought to be ashamed of himself that he's allowing her not, you know, that he's keeping her outside of the room. There's no reason for it. And, you know, this doesn't negate all of, you know, the good things that the governor has done in the budget, but certainly we ought to have our own voice. And I think actually it would be helpful to him, because I think there's so many places that we agree with the governor, that he would actually be helped in those negotiations by having Senator Stuart Cousins in those negotiations, both advocating on behalf of her constituents and the issues expressed by our conference, but also the things that we agree with the governor on.
Senator, I want to go back to education for a second, because it is such a sticking point in budget negotiations between the two houses and the governor's office. So you're a veteran of Albany, and you were here when the state's highest court ruled in the on the campaign for fiscal equity lawsuit that the state was not providing a sound basic education, and Governor Spitzer made some real effort to settle that lawsuit and to try to put more money into the system. With the administration of Governor Patterson and now continuing with Governor Cuomo, we've seen a failure to live up to that commitment and underfunding of schools. So we've got sort of two things that are being discussed. Both the Senate and the Assembly want to add more money to the budget to address those concerns. And also one of the things that you mentioned is a reform, and I put quotes around that, that the governor's talking about, which would deny teachers some of their due process rights that they've had for in this state for more than 100 years. So it is an interesting linkage. At the same time, the governor is now saying, you know, maybe I'll put some more money into the budget, but you have to make some of these reforms, which really do sort of target teachers. And some have said, including the leader of your conference, that the governor is demonizing teachers.
Yeah, I certainly think that in some ways it seems that those policies demonize teachers. And I think we've already agreed. And frankly, the teachers union has agreed that teacher evaluation should be part of the process. And 3 or 4 years ago, we already voted on it, right? And so teacher evaluations already exist. I think right now it's up to the governor and the members of the teachers union to actually negotiate outside of the budget, you know, how the implementation of that. I mean, it's the governor's job to implement policy. We've already said that teacher evaluation exists. There's no need to actually bring up more, measures in a bill. He should just negotiate it with the teachers union, and they should work out, you know, amongst themselves, you know, how this thing should be actually implemented. And that's really, I think, in my opinion, not as much of a job for the legislature. However, the funding of schools is a job for the legislature. And right now, the state of New York is out of compliance, not with what advocates say, not with what I say, but with what the courts have said is a gross underfunding of New York City public schools. What we have agreed to as a legislature is that funding should not just go to New York City schools, but to low-performing schools across the state of New York, from Buffalo to Brooklyn to Brookhaven, New York. And so we ought to be just following the court order and putting more money in without all of these gimmicks. And again, if the governor doesn't want to put more money in, I have suggested a zero-sum alternative to him, which is that, let's say there's 100 low-performing schools. Let's take the top 100, you know, well-performing schools, and let's equalize the money in all the schools, being that he thinks that money is not, the reason why schools are performing low. And let's see whether the students and the parents in those high-performing schools think that the equalization of money with low-performing schools is the way that you want to go if he wants a zero-sum solution. I think that there is enough money, particularly with the significant extra money that we've had this year, a surplus, that education ought to be a priority. And that's simply what most of my conferences said, is that budgets are not so much about dollars and cents as they are about priorities. And so if our priority, we say that young people are our future, if we say that education is important, then we want to be funding it first and then doing corporate welfare and some of these other things later. And this whole budget process, I have not seen one corporate CEO come to me and say that they're not getting their money and not getting, you know, their support. But I have school children up here every week looking for more money, whether it's K-12 education or additional TAP or financial aid for the opportunity programs for higher education. So we really want to put our money where our mouth is and make education, both K-12 and higher education, real priorities in this budget.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we're speaking with Senator Kevin Parker, State Senate's Assistant Democratic Conference Leader. One public policy issue that he's particularly expert on is health care, and pays a lot of attention to the health budget negotiations going on. Is there anything contentious in the health field this year?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the generous introduction. I'm not sure if I would call myself an expert. But to the degree I know anything is because I've been forced into it because of the crisis that we've experienced in Brooklyn over the last few years with hospitals either closing or being threatened to close almost on a yearly basis. And I think that there's a lot of things that are contentious. But a lot of it is around the Medicaid funding formula and about reimbursement rates. I think that to give the governor credit, I think he's done better with that, far better than that than he's done in some other areas. Particularly want to commend him for some of the bailouts that he's attempting to do with money both to Brooklyn as well as to some of the upstate hospitals that certainly need some revitalization and some reform in terms of how their systems operate. I think that we have neglected as a state to properly manage the change in healthcare with Obamacare and some of the other things that are happening with our insurance companies. And we certainly need to continue to move in a direction where we are not just looking at individual health services from individual hospitals, but do what the governor has suggested, which is, you know, build systems within regional areas to make sure that people are getting comprehensive coverage. And so it's not about any longer funding institutions, whether it's health centers or hospitals, but it's really about funding healthcare. And that's the direction that I think we're going into. And this budget, I think, takes a big step in going in that way, but not big enough, but we're going in the right direction.
How do you think the budget conference committee process is working, both generally and in specific fields like health? Have you had a chance to get a glimpse of the workings of this conference committee process?
Yeah, I think that the members in the conference committee process are doing the best they can. The process is not much of a process. If some of your listeners who are not involved in the day-to-day machinations of Albany look at the numbers, they look impressive, but they really are not impressive amounts of money. So if I tell you that, you know, a table has $70 million, it's like, oh, wow, $70 million. I mean, if the three of us split $70 million, it would change our lives. But in the context of a $148 billion budget, $70 million is really a rounding error. And so there are really micro decisions being made as opposed to broad sweeping policy discussions happening at these tables. It's not really quite as meaningful as the process might have you believe it is. But to the degree that the process actually works to address some of the issues in communities, it works to a certain degree outside of the fact that, again, as you know, the Democratic minority is underrepresented at those tables. And so a lot of our constituencies aren't really being helped by the budget process.
Senator, as a representative of your conference, I'm going to ask you a question. A number of advocates have been somewhat critical of the Democratic minority in the Senate over the last few years for oftentimes not really standing up to the governor, for going along with some of his proposals that might not be considered very progressive. I have to say this year, the Senate Minority Conference has been very vocal about some of the disagreements they had with the governor over education, sometimes over charter schools, over ethics reform. Can you sort of explain the change in direction with your conference?
Well, it has to do also with the change of the policies, right? Every year, you know, the policies are different. And when we disagree, we've disagreed. And when we have thought that the governor was going and the state was going in the right direction, we've gone along, you know, with those ideas. And I think this year there's just a lot more. I mean, frankly, our budget last year was just a much better budget last year, right? And so if last year you didn't see a whole bunch of, you know, gnashing of teeth, it was, you know, a lot because, fully funded UPK and put more money into education and more money into TAP. And, you know, there was money in places that we requested money. And so there was frankly just less, you know, to complain about. This year, we have not seen that either from the process perspective in which we talked about, where Andrea Stewart-Cousins, the only woman who is the leader of a legislative conference in the state of New York and the leader of the Democratic Conference of the State Senate, is being excluded from the budget negotiations. And also, as we look at the substantive numbers, in things like education, higher education, transportation, there's not necessarily money going into the places that we think that they should be going into, including money into the pockets of the people, you know, the people in the state. We still, you know, not only was the DREAM Act initially included in the governor's executive budget, but now has been taken out.
Let me interrupt for a second. When you say it's been taken out, what's happened?
My understanding is that it's dropped off the table, that in the new versions that the DREAM Act will not be included in the budget. And if in fact that's the case, I mean, we have a couple more days to negotiate this, but we certainly want to see the DREAM Act included in the budget this year. And in addition to that, we don't have, I know there's been conversations about, and it was a proposal about the minimum wage, but we still have not seen a real minimum wage for the state with a COLA, with an automatic COLA attached. We want to see a COLA, a cost of living increase to the minimum wage, so that the minimum wage and the wages of hardworking men and women and their families in the state don't have to have their wages used as a political football every budget season. And that hasn't been included. There's no reason for us not to do that this year. And so, you know, when we don't see the things that our constituencies, when we don't see the needs and the desires and the wants of our constituents, the people of the state of New York, not being addressed, it's up to us to speak truth to power and raise our voices to those concerns. And that's what you've seen Andrea Stewart-Cousins doing, and myself and other members of our conference this year, more than you have in past years, because more than ever, in the face of a surplus, we're still not getting the needs of our communities addressed. And that's also what you saw reflected in those poll numbers by Sienna.
Overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. So now that we're getting down to the nitty-gritty of the budget negotiations, as the senator just mentioned, two particular issues, the DREAM Act and the Education Investment Tax Credit, seem to be possibly on the chopping block. But the governor or the governor's spokesperson is insisting that they need to see ethics reform in the budget deal. So some might say it's interesting that the governor, who took down the Moreland Commission that he had set up, is now so stuck on ethics reform. Do you think we're going to see an ethics reform deal?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a week ago, you saw an iconic hug between the Speaker of the Assembly and the governor, and I thought that was the first step or the opening salvo to make sure that ethics reform is a significant part of this budget deal. And so I'm not sure, again, because Andrea Stewart-Cousins, the leader of the Democratic Senate, has not been included in the budget negotiations, it's difficult for me to speak to where we are on those issues because we're not getting reports on it because our leader has been excluded from the negotiations. But my understanding is that it's still conversation. And I expect that everybody, given all that has happened in the news this year, knows that we as a state legislature need to address the issues of ethics. And I expect that there will be a reform package included in the budget.
Well, it did look like one of the sticking points that the Senate Republican majority wanted to see in ethics reform was the naming of campaign donors to the executive who received state contracts, and that was not in the deal between the Assembly and the governor. So it's interesting that the Senate is sort of holding out for more extensive disclosure than the governor has been willing to provide up to this point.
Yeah, there's a lot of in the Republican Senate, there's a lot of people who are attorneys, and so there was a lot of conversation and a lot of language around disclosing who their clients are. And I think that the Senate is now saying, well, we're going to have to disclose who our clients are. You're going to need to have to disclose who your donors are. And, fair is fair. And so hopefully we'll see something that reflects, a good negotiation and frankly, some sunshine on all this stuff. I think all of it should be disclosed. I think the governor should be disclosing who his donors are, and certainly people who have clients should have to disclose, who these clients are if it doesn't, impede the criminal justice process.
We're speaking with State Senator Kevin Parker, who's Assistant Democratic Conference Leader in the State Senate. Let's turn for a moment from these big issues dealing with the state budget and major front burner issues to a more specific issue that you've been involved in recently. Tell us about the bill you've introduced recently dealing with chronic wounds. What's the issue and what would your bill do?
Yeah, the issue is around a specific modality called topical oxygen wound therapy. And topical oxygen wound therapy is actually something that's been around for about 20 years. And about a decade ago, the state of New York actually approved it as a therapy to be used and funded by Medicaid. And they're now have, over the last year, are saying that it's no longer, that has simply taken it off that list. Now, what topical oxygen wound therapy actually is used for is a lot of sores, bed sores, the kind of lesions and wounds that oftentimes occur, particularly by diabetes. If you know anybody who has type 2 diabetes, they oftentimes develop these kind of wounds. And they found that not only is topical oxygen wound therapy the most effective use of it, but it's also actually more cost-effective, both because it's just a cheaper application, but also because it heals wounds faster and more completely than other modalities that are being used right now. And so myself and Assemblyman Felix Ortiz have co-sponsored a bill that would have the state continue to not just keep this on an approved modality list, but also would fund it through Medicaid. And that's, I think, important, particularly because so many of those with type 2 diabetes are found in the Black and Latino communities. And they also happen to be, parenthetically, a significant portion of the Medicaid population. We want to make sure that our constituents have access to this therapy that is both effective and cost-effective.
Okay, well, thank you very much for paying attention to an issue like this. I can appreciate the concern that people have in these specific issues, and they frequently don't get the attention they deserve. Senator Parker, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
No, thanks for having me. I look forward to talking to you guys again soon.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, we greatly appreciate it. This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee. We're pleased to work with Jerry Zahavi and Susan McCormick, who keep Capital District Progressive Radio on the air, and with WRPI's management for keeping the station active in public affairs programming. Brian, before we finish up. Have you heard anything more about whether or not there's any chance that the legislature will pass a legislative budget, that they will, before the deadline, at least as a stopgap measure, pass something that puts into place what they can agree on, so the governor doesn't have the power he has in the case of a late budget?
So it's hard to tell, and it depends on who you talk to. But, you know, for the last month, there's been an undercurrent of sort of pushback from legislators who were not happy with the heavy-handed way that the governor had approached this budget, particularly with the 30-day amendments that the governor added into the budget at the 11th hour. There are a number of people who believe that the governor has overplayed his hand in the executive privilege that the governor always has in crafting a budget. And there's talk that Senator Skelos and Speaker Hastie are having conversations. And, you know, I think there are still a number of issues that the two houses don't have agreement on, but they're talking. And I think there's a general consensus that unrelated budget items that, you know, clearly don't belong in the budget should be put aside. And if the governor wants to force the nuclear option, they may be willing to step up their game as well.
Okay. This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy. And Assemblyman Marcus Crespo, since speaking to us, talked about the Silver versus Pataki lawsuit, which gives the governor a lot of power. But there are some openings for the legislature to take the lead. And there's a possibility that something dramatic might happen later this week or early next week. So let's see what happens. This is the People's Business. We'll be with you again in April. But right now, stay tuned for Democracy Now!